Hello and welcome to the ERP Organizational Change Journal podcast, brought to you by Nestle & Associates. Nestle & Associates is an ERP organizational change management firm serving the private equity industry. My name is Jonathan Donald, the founder of Invert Ventures, a change strategy firm. And today I'm co-hosting with my dear friend and colleague, Dr. Jack Nestle, the founder of Nestle & Associates. The ERP Organizational Change Journal podcast seeks to share expertise, insight, and create effective conversation to help guide ERP organizational change to real, measurable, and verified success, to expand what we see so we can act in a more effective way. We seek to promote, connect, and foster relationships in the ERP and organizational change community. The primary purpose of this podcast is to discuss, share, and reflect upon effective and efficient ways in which to realize ERP organizational change success. We will discuss the people, process, and technological components of ERP organizational change. This podcast is intended as a forum to study, share, and discuss ERP organizational change. It's our sincere hope that this will be a collaboration tool and resource, and that we hope you will find this podcast useful as we share lessons learned, explore best practices, and discover the human elements of ERP organizational change. Our podcast draws on knowledge from extensive research, collaborative learning, and practitioner experience of both project successes and failures. A general review of the theme of ERP and organizational change practice, literature, and research suggests that an understanding and critically an awareness of tactics founded in principle is fundamental to ERP organizational change success. We'll discuss these tactics, explore these approaches, and discover the principles that may be useful in addressing your ERP organizational change challenge and risks. We look forward to having you join us. Jack?
Thank you, Jonathan. We are a podcast that desires to engage in valuable insight into the world of ERP organizational change success with interviews and roundtable talk. Our guests include experts and pioneers in the field, which include organizational stakeholders, practitioners, and researchers. We are a discussion on any and all things ERP and organizational change. Our podcast is a platform for those seeking to share, learn, and reflect on ERP organizational change success.
In this episode, we will discuss the value of business intelligence, understanding and measuring operational issues with Mr. Tim Van Meegen. Please note, our conversation with Tim will be a two-part conversation. Mr. Van Meegen is a partner of the ProAction Group, an operational consulting firm, which he co-founded in 1995. Tim has 30-plus years of experience helping middle-market companies identify, quantify, and mine latent value. He is widely recognized for his expertise in supply chain functions and as an author of the Implementing Supplier Partnership book. He's known for presenting at national and local conferences and creating numerous articles on value creation, sourcing, and logistics. In addition, he created the firm's proprietary 9-box inventory and pricing tool, which has helped countless companies optimize their inventory levels and improve their pricing practices.
Thank you, Jonathan. In this episode, we will explore and discuss some key business intelligence concepts, including data-driven decision-making, systems audits, process-driven leadership, key performance indicators, and innovatively incorporating technology. This episode will discuss how to turn data into insight that is actionable. Timely and accurate visibility to operational data is a significant competitive differentiator. We will discuss many people, processes, and technological influences that help ensure organizational business intelligence, availability, and alignment. We will explore with Tim the challenge of strategic decision making. I read in one of Tim's articles where he wrote that a Scottish wisdom leaves it to an old-time Scotsman to lay down some business wisdom over a century ago that still rings loudly today. Quote, he uses statistics as a drunken man uses lamppost, for support rather than for illumination, end quote. Andrew Lang, Scottish poet, 1910. Unfortunately, many modern business executives do just that. using data to support recommended actions rather than identifying insightful actions from the data. We will explore this idea on this episode. Tim is a friend who, along with his partners, has continued to see success at the ProAction Group. When I've collaborated with Tim and his team on projects in the past, I learn something new every time. I believe that Tim and his colleagues established a business founded in principle that works and includes effective and efficient evidence-based inquiry. Tim, thank you so much for being on our show today. Welcome to our podcast.
Thank you, Jack. Thank you, Jonathan. It's great to be here with you.
Tim, I'm so excited for this conversation. Turning data into insight is a real hobby of mine.
I love it, too. We get to see it from the operations standpoint, and it can change lives and companies. So I'm very glad
Absolutely.
To be here.
Absolutely. All right. Well, hey, let's dive in. Tim, my first question for you today is to get us warmed up. How would you describe data-driven decision-making and its value to organizations?
Yeah, you know, there's a few areas that'll be kind of themes throughout our conversation today. The first one I'm going to say is to build support for difficult decisions. And the kind of the gut approach or the data-free approach means that someone has to already believe something needs to be done before they're going to go ahead and do it. What I love about Sure. data is it's one of the few things that can actually change someone's mind. And when you don't already have support for something, you have to have data. Data may not be enough to get them over that hump, but if you don't have data, it will never happen. Second is I think it enables companies to make good decisions. And there's a lot to talk about in here because, you know, data can be powerful, and it can be powerful in leading you the right way, or if it's misinterpreted or poorly thought through, it can lead you the wrong direction, but it can lead to good decisions, and it's required for, let me put it this way, it's required for consistently good decisions. There's an old joke my dad always used to say that sometimes it's better to be lucky than good.
Yeah.
And I would add right. to it, it's better to be excellent than lucky. And the only way you'll be excellent is to actually make data-based decisions.
Mm. Great point.
Another one that, yeah, I love that one. Another one that I think builds off of something you said in the intro is the ability for it to help you to break through what you think is possible. That, you know, we all go into things with pre-existing concepts or conceptualizations.
Sure.
Data can lead us to things where we say, oh, I can do that differently. Another one is, you know, the importance of ownership. It helps to enable people to take ownership. If they have a general gut feeling of how they're doing, that's one thing. But if they know specifically and it's clear, it's like I heard this one phrase recently that I love, which is transparency is kind. Like actually giving people feedback is actually kindness. And holding it back is not.
Mm.
So when you have data, you can have transparency, which enables people to take ownership of what they're doing. And the last one I'll say, which I love too, is it's kind of a prerequisite for developing a problem-solving culture. And any high-performing company is essentially, they instead of the blame game, where they're always trying to figure out who's at fault when something didn't happen, they look at which you might consider failures or exceptions as opportunities to learn and to improve. And data, I think, is required for that to be nurtured.
Great insight. I love that, Tim. I'm going to use that. Transparency is kind. What a great way to put it. I really like that.
I stole that from Brené Brown, who wrote the book Dare to Lead.
Ah, okay. All right.
Beautiful, wonderful book.
I was thinking where I've heard that before.
Yes.
I'm really excited to have this conversation around data-driven decision-making. And I think those three themes that you laid out are really instructive. I want to just give us a little bit of context for our listeners. So I'm going to dive in here and quote one of your ProAction articles. So in some cases, all area systems audit is the right starting point. And you also mentioned that sometimes more of a surveillance audit is required. What we're talking about here is where are the opportunities for applying data-driven decision-making within operations? What part of the gap analysis can identify those areas for cost reduction or profit improvement? Let's start there for our listeners who may not be familiar with this in the context of operations.
Yes, thank you. No, that's very good. So I'll use a metaphor or an example to set the stage. A lot of times we'll go in as an example, and I will ask an executive, look, we're going to talk about pricing as a topic, and I'll ask the CEO, how does your pricing strategy work? And they'll describe something that is really elegant and thoughtful. You know, they put a lot of good thought into it, and it'd probably be a good Harvard Business Case Review if somebody wanted to document it. And then you go look at the data, and you see what's actually happening. Or you go and watch a salesperson actually sell, and you see what's actually happening. And so one of those, in a way, you've got a systems audit where you look at what's the documentation, what are the processes that they've set up to manage the business. Then you go and actually look at what they do, and you get to compare the two. And then other times we'll go and interview the executives, and then we'll interview the people who are supervising, each different department or division. And then, we get to triangulate those and then compare them to what we would know to be effective practices that a high-performing company might utilize. And that's what leads to the gap analysis. Mm-hmm. So what's beautiful, and, people tend to fear change. And if things are working, they don't like to ask hard questions about, could we be doing better? And one of the things, we work oftentimes with in a M&A environment, and it's beautiful because when somebody takes over as the owner of a company, it's a natural time to take a step back and say, let's look at our systems, let's look at what's actually happening, and develop that gap analysis and say, how much better can we or should we be? We've all heard, I think, of companies that grow. If they're growing and they have good margins, very few times do they have the discipline to say, how well are we operating? And then they end up sometimes at a point where there's now competition and their pricing margin has been cut, or they lose a customer, or something happens and that, that extra fluff goes away and they have a tough time. And the companies that really continue to succeed are the ones who, while they're growing, are still asking the question, can we be doing this better?
This is something I really want to highlight for our listeners, right? The notion of possibility. Oh, what can we be doing differently here that might actually generate nonlinear results? And if I'm understanding you, Tim, the system audit, surveillance audit, and gap analysis all build on each other. And my experience of listening to you here is that the system audit is, let's see what the business plan says. Let's listen to the executive. Right. Let's look at the system. And you do something, at least in operational due diligence, that my friends who do a lot of behavioral work love, which is you actually look at people and the behaviors that they do. And so the gap between those two, which in almost any organization is apparent, you present as data that executives can see. And so it's almost as though you take something that is intangible and give it to them in a way that's tangible. Am I understanding that right?
Yeah, you said it very well, Jonathan. And I would add one more piece to it too, especially since we're talking about data. If we go back to that pricing example,
sure.
And we give the example that says, hey, this is what you described your pricing strategy to be, and then here's what we've witnessed with salespeople, that does paint a picture and it provides some qualitative evidence. If you go the next step further and you actually look at the patterns of their gross margins or their margins based on mm-hmm. things like the size of the customer, the size or the SKU or the service and how significant that is, you should expect to see things like as your customers get smaller, the margins should get higher. And as the services get more and more unique and designed and crafted, the margins should go up. And sometimes you find, for example, desperate salespeople who are selling to smaller customers will do anything to make a sale. And if they're allowed to by the company, that'll happen. And that's when you see lower margins for smaller customers. And the data is unarguable or inarguable they might be able to, you know, argue against the example I provide, but when I back that up, when we back that up with actual data, it's very stark and clear. And it changes the tone of that conversation dramatically.
Yeah, so true. Great insight. Tim, you and I have discussed before how post-acquisition your team helps portfolio companies transition to a scalable, what you call process-driven leadership path. And I find this choice of words, quote, process-driven leadership path, interesting. It always catches my attention. Can you explain to our listeners what you mean by that?
Yes, I'm glad to. So when we're getting involved, oftentimes an entrepreneur is bringing on an investor or like a private equity firm who's providing capital, financial capital. They may also be providing contact or network capital by bringing them into new big clients. They may bring in expertise and help them. Basically, they want to scale. Almost every private equity firm investment thesis includes scaling the business at some level. And, you know, if you think about an entrepreneurial company, that entrepreneur or their predecessor started the company out of sheer willpower. They started something from nothing. They created something from nothing. And the people who do that are the people who have a very clear vision and they want it done. They want it done their way. And they're sort of the conductor. Centralized control, they tell people what to do, and they're like a conductor in an orchestra, pointing at people and saying, you do this now and then. And it really works. It works very well while the company's forming. We also find a couple of things here. They have the people that come in early, stay with them, and they're people that they might start on the shop floor or, you know, at a clerk level in a department, and then they rise because they learn, they know how to serve that entrepreneur, and there's trust built.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a long, and they tend to promote from within. You know, they tend to lead by gut experience and willpower. That's what worked. That's what got them to where they were. But what that ends up happening then is the scale is limited to the bandwidth of that leader. That's one of the fundamental issues with maintaining an entrepreneurial approach to running a company. And one thing that I've noticed too, this isn't consistent, like it doesn't always happen, but when things don't go right, when there's a failure, there's an exception or what have you, you know, we do find often that blame kind of culture where they're like, whose fault was this? They don't have the clarity and data or approach to really view this as a problem-solving thing. And oftentimes the entrepreneur saves the day. You know, they come in and kind of are the hero. And then you kind of compare that to a process-oriented leader where the entrepreneur is the center of control. The process-oriented leader wants to actively empower the lowest practical level of the organization to complete a task or a requirement.
Sure.
To do that, right, to do that, you have to have clear standard operating procedures, processes, approaches, systems that let people know what they need to do, when, and where they have rope, you know, or flexibility in how they do what they do, and where they have to stay within their lanes, like guardrails on a bowling alley. Another interesting, with the process-oriented leaders too, they're often more open to new people, and the long-tenured management, on the one hand, it's beautiful because they have a lot of trust and tribal knowledge of how to run the company, but they also have very little experience about how things are done anywhere else. And if they're coachable and they're ready to make a transition to go from being sort of a, you know, implementing what the entrepreneur told them to do to someone who is, it can think and I don't, you know, obviously everybody's thinking, but to be more of a strategic leader themselves, where they take ownership of their department or area or group or task and they build their vision for how that's going to serve the company. That's a big, big transition.
Absolutely.
It's required. And, you know, there's a couple of other ones too, but instead of leading by gut experience and willpower, you will start to implement data and metrics and that concept of you have to inspect what you expect. and give people the authority to do their job.
So, Tim, I'm sitting here and I find myself super curious, and I tend to follow my curiosity, especially when it's on these podcasts. I want to take a second and just explore this idea with you around the entrepreneurial sort of control leader versus the process leader, because that's a dynamic I see in organizations of many sizes. You can certainly find that that's not unique to entrepreneurs. You can find that in divisions of large companies. What I want to explore, though, is what you beautifully laid out was a human transition between how do I empower those who are not me to, in your language, save the day. What I want to focus this conversation on is what role does data systems have in that human process? Because that is not an easy human transformation. So what role does the data tool give an entrepreneur or a controlling leader the ability to become that process leader? Can you speak to that based on your experience?
No, I would be glad to. And, you know, it starts first by, and this is something wonderful that private equity firms and new investors bring to the table often, is they have an investment thesis where we want to, you know, grow, we want to expand into new markets, we want to add SKUs or customers, whatever it might be. So we now have sort of a clear mission of what we're trying to accomplish. And mm-hmm. then you work with the entrepreneur to develop the metrics, leading indicators, lagging indicators that are relevant to your investment thesis and that will tend to align the behavior of the people in the organization to the strategy, okay? And that is one of my favorite quotes is in this regard is to be careful what you ask for.
Yeah.
Because you're going to get it, right? Later
in this conversation.
Yes.
I'm sure we're going to have a great great insight there as well.
Yes, absolutely. And so my point is that data becomes useful. It becomes information when you've developed your clear vision and you know what you're measuring, and doing that well up front, how the data you have can relate to your strategy and to your vision is that first step. We have to do that piece first. And then that becomes an education piece where the awareness that people have of their power and their role in the organization becomes a lot clearer when you have data and KPIs.
Mm.
That's where it starts, I believe. You know, that's where it has to start.
So we're gonna definitely continue this thread about what data can actually do for organizational culture and allowing people to do. I want to zoom out a little bit and talk about ProAction's areas of expertise for our listeners in lean manufacturing and operational due diligence and your work with private equity companies. Can you give us a little bit of an overview for our listeners about what that really looks like?
So we'll focus on lean manufacturing here. And, you know, I originally kind of thought about it as process improvement, and that's not untrue or process reengineering.
Mm-hmm.
But the more I learn about and understand lean, it's about eliminating waste. You know, and waste in systems include things like delays, rework, errors, slow processes, waiting, transportation, producing things that you're not going to use until later. Okay? These are all things that get in the way of people who are trying to do their jobs. And some of the best leaders of lean organizations are servant leaders. You know, they view their role as I'm going to enable and empower my people, my team, and help them achieve what they can achieve.
Sure.
I'm going to be a support, a servant, right? And lean is really well focused on that. It's about getting the obstacles out of the way of your team to prevent them from doing their job. So, like, here's one example of where this was clear as day. We were working at a building products company. They made, like, infrastructure for warehouses. And one of the key roles in the company was welding. And welders, you know, in the last few years, they're hard to come by. There's not enough welders in the industry for all the welding that has to be done. And when we looked at their people who were welders, they spent less than half their time welding. They were walking to get tools. They were walking to get parts. They were, you know, helping people with other tasks. And when you think about, boy, it's difficult to get welders, yet our welders, literally, we could double their capacity if we set this up so that they don't do things that aren't welding. And that, you know, that concept is a very powerful one throughout Lean. It's one of the things that add value. And everything else, we try to get that out of their way. When they have to walk, when they have to search, when they have to wait, those things are just waste. And they prevent people from achieving what they could achieve.
Sure. And Tim, you're really inverting the question. So instead of what is, here's their total time, what are the things that are preventing them from welding all the time? And that's giving you an opportunity to see that.
Yeah. Like here's an example. Like we had a client that made chocolate bars, and we calculated, we put all the tasks together that for starting from when a raw cocoa bean is brought into the building to the time a chocolate bar is shipped out the back door. And the percentage of time that value was added to that chocolate bar was less than 1%. 99% of the time and more that cocoa bean was in the building, nothing was being done to transform it into a chocolate bar. It was sitting in inventory. It was being moved. You know, it was in a queue, or sometimes there's reworked really clear things that are not, you know, value added. And so improving that 1% is not nearly as important as reducing the 99%. If you doubled your efficiency by being better at what you do add value in, but you spend less than 1% of your time actually adding value, you're much better off to get rid of that 99% first or get it to 10%. If you could, companies that spend 10% of the time actually adding value when products or materials are in the building are very high performing companies, very high performing companies. But it's that you caught on. That's exactly kind of the point. And it's such a fun part of what we do, because at the end of the day, it's not about making people work faster or harder or putting bigger goals on them. It's about making their life easier. It's about taking stuff out of their way that's making it hard to do what they do.
And I want to highlight this for our listeners, right? When we're talking about operational efficiency, oftentimes it comes in a sort of Winslow-Taylor or Taylor-esque approach, which is, you know, this is the right way to do this, 22 minutes shoveling or moving this. What we're talking about here is how do you actually free up the role so that they spend less time doing things that don't add value? And that's it sounds like it's a much easier role to sell within a organization from a change perspective.
Once people understand it, there's a difficulty because it's a little bit counterintuitive. That's where things like data can really help in the process. But yeah, it is. Once people, especially once they understand it, it's the easy sell.
Tim, your experience, insight, and observations are so rich. You act like you've done this stuff before.
Well, my wonderful colleagues have done a lot more here at ProAction, but I'm happy to be around it.
But I'm
participating in my own way.
Tim, I know firsthand that ProAction is heavily focused on this idea of leadership support and sending the right message to the organization. And I know we've discussed this before, this idea of using ERP and data to improve inventory and support, you know, as you discussed, lean manufacturing, right? That is looking at inventory requirements, demand patterns, capacities, and lead times, and rebalancing your storage space, internal and external. But sometimes this is easier said than done, right? But number one, kind of a two-part, I guess, question. One is, how do you leverage ERP for this effort? And two, how do you win support from organizational leadership team to take that action? Any comments on that idea?
Yeah, that's a Great question. You know, an inventory is a great topic. I love this because the idea that we have to reduce inventory to increase sales is counterintuitive. Okay. It's like you, and it makes sense. You go talk to someone who's leading a company and they will say, I can't sell from empty cart. Right. And when we come in and oftentimes we say, gosh, we have to reduce inventory to increase sales. They're like, they look at us like we have two heads. So it's a difficult sell. And the idea that we may need to rationalize some SKUs or services that we offer to increase the overall profitability of the company is counterintuitive. The idea that we may need to treat customers differently, like, you know, A customers, B customers, and C customers, is also counterintuitive, especially for companies that are still working to grow. You know, they're eager to grow. And what we found on this is that because it's so counterintuitive, you have to have data to change their minds. Okay. And what we have found, the beautiful thing is if you can extract their sales history, and almost every company, especially if they have an ERP system, they can extract their sales history and their inventory data. Okay. If you have those two pieces of data, the modeling techniques, and you, I think you brought up our 9-box tool. It's a segmentation, like an 80-20 kind of tool that's out there. When you can slice and dice it that way, you can get real. And one thing real quick, the idea that we have to reduce inventory to increase sales, why that works. I've thought about this so much because I'm like, this doesn't make sense. Why is it true? And I finally realized this. If you're using your capacity and your capital to make or buy inventory that you're going to sell in 2 or 3 months, you are not using it to make or buy or sell something that you want to sell today.
Yeah.
That is the problem. And that's why the number one waste in lean manufacturing is considered overproduction. It's making something today that you don't need for 2 more months or whatever that time frame is. And to help people over that, when things are counterintuitive, you have to hold their hand and walk them through. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the beautiful things about data. When you can show them the return on their investment in inventory for different SKUs and for different customers, it makes it real. They can look at it and say, wow. And what ends up happening is here's a fun thing you get to tell them. Here's where you made money, and here's where you gave it back. I heard one, this wasn't my project, but I heard it from a friend of mine who did this exact analysis for a client. And they segmented it into high-volume SKUs sold to high-volume customers and everything else. And they said, how much of your profit do you think comes from the high-volume SKUs that you sell to your large customers? And, you know, they were guessing, I don't know, 80%, 90%, 95%. And he told them it was 160%.
Wow.
Yes. When you take into account the cost of, you know, small orders or small customers, it was dramatic. Okay. It's not always that dramatic, but that is the starting point. When you can show a senior leadership team this data, it makes it real. And then they're willing to come. You know, talking to a VP of sales and saying, we want to fire this customer, or if we want to start charging them freight, or we want them to pay if they're going to break into our line and order within lead times. That's going to be super hard. But when you show them the data that says, look, why do we want them as a customer? This is what they're costing us today. It doesn't make any sense. That's the thing you need to start with to get people to make a tough decision. And inventory and SKU rationalization and customer rationalization is one of the most difficult decisions for someone to make, because it's so counterintuitive.
So really, Tim, just to summarize, you know, what you're saying is transparency is kind, right? So
yes.
With transparency,
yes.
And if you're looking for the right things and you're accurately measuring the right metrics, you are building a sound business case in which you use to help support your decision, right? And then that helps organizational leadership be informed and have the conversation and ask questions about the data. But, you know, at the end of the day, you let the data drive and support the decision to do the right thing.
Yes. And if you don't mind, I'd like to add one more thing to this too, that I think is really critical. So the data is very important, but I also believe, and this goes to something Jonathan talked about before, about the human side of this, start with discussions. Learn what they do today. Ask people, you know, how they manage this, how they look at it today.
Great point.
And why they do it the way they do it. One of my partner, Doug Blanchard, one of the first things he taught me was don't change something you don't understand.
Yeah, great
and
point.
The data helps. Mm. Yeah, the data helps. And here's the other part, too. A lot of times when people have reservations about a change, making a change in their business or in their life, it's not because they disagree as much as they don't feel heard. And, you know, like, for example, they may say you can't drop the SKU because it's part of a package and it's strategic and whatever. If you start by telling us, you know, tell us why this SKU is important to you, well, this, this, and this, then now they feel heard and you can say back to them, I understand. And it takes a lot of the pressure, a lot of the angst out of the situation, and you can now more focus on the data, and it's more of a problem-solving exercise than a, you know, strength of will exercise.
So true. Great, great insight.
Tim, I'm sitting here as wearing my change strategist hat, nodding my head. Because what you brilliantly do there is you turn it from a loss exercise to what could this look like? What insight do you have that I don't that could be helpful in resolving this?
Yes.
And oftentimes resistance to a change, even when the data is in support, isn't necessarily resistance. And it's not always just being heard. Sometimes it's the worry of if we lose this product and I'm an expert here, am I still going to be competent?
Right.
You know, this is my power base, my client base. So oftentimes the unwillingness to look at that makes things more opaque than it clarifies.
Yep. And it's also like trying to go to third base from first. You really need to go to second base before you go to third. And if you go too fast and you skip that part, you're going to miss a lot of the nuance of what the real problem is.
Hi, listeners. Just a reminder that this conversation with Tim is a two-part conversation. Part one was this week, and part two will be in next week's episode. Please join us as we continue the rich discussion, the value of business intelligence, understanding and measuring operational issues with Mr. Tim Van Meegem.
We are incredibly excited and grateful to have friends, colleagues, and mentors join us on our podcast. We have an incredible lineup of ERP and organizational change speakers, authors, professors, researchers, pioneers in the field, practitioners, PE partners, business executives, ERP vendors, and organizational stakeholders. Thank you for joining us on today's episode. We invite you to leave us feedback and a review. We want to make sure this is the most useful and insightful podcast you listen to, and we need your help to do so.
Thank you, listeners, for being with us as we seek to, one, promote, connect, and foster relationships in the ERP organizational change community, two, contribute to the field of ERP organizational change, and three, bring research and practice closer together. Please join us again next week as we discuss the latest ERP organizational change research, practice, and stories. Our podcast will draw on knowledge from extensive research, collaborative learning, and practitioner expertise and experience. Hashtag the ERP Organizational Change Journal.
From everyone here on the team, Jack and myself, we wish you a great week, and we hope to see you again soon on another episode. Take care.